Hi, I'm Carlin Appy, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Hello, and thanks for joining us. I just spoke with Jim Millward about his new book, The Silk Road, A Very Short Introduction. This was published with the Oxford Very Short Introduction series just very recently in 2013. This is a book that is very concise, it's very readable, the prose is very vivacious, very vibrant, and what it essentially is an introduction to Silk Road history that's meant for a general reader, someone who's maybe not necessarily an expert in the subject, and that can also be used to teach in courses that touch on or are devoted to Silk Road history or world history or Central Eurasian history in a number of different ways. So the book, rather than trying to simply distill a kind of narrative thread that you can see repeated in a lot of popular and current Silk Road histories, what the book tries to do is take an approach that engages some contemporary problems in Silk Road history and in world history, and to bring them out and make them part of the narrative in what's a very engaging way, in a way that really engages the reader's critical faculties and critical sense, and doesn't just try to lecture at you about facts related to Silk Road history. So it's very interesting in that way. Over the course of our conversation, we talked about not just Jim's approach to teaching Silk Road history, to how we came to this project, but also some themes that emerge from the chapters in this book and from the structural decisions that he made when putting together the narrative that are very broadly germane to really any attempt to write world history, global history, to engage with those issues, or to talk about exchanges broadly writ in the historical record and today as well. We also talked about lutes and banjos, so definitely stick around for the last part of the conversation for that part of the talk. Okay, well, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy the book, and I hope you enjoy the conversation as well. We're here today to talk with James Millward about his new book, The Silk Road, A Very Short Introduction. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Jim, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Carla. I'm so pleased to be here.
So could you start us off by saying really just a little bit about yourself and your background? What brought you to the field of Central Eurasian studies?
Well, I started out, way back when in college as a classics major, and through various sort of turnings, ended up having a chance to go to China when I was sort of between my sophomore and junior year. And this was back in the early 1980s, 1981 it was. And a couple things sort of came out of that. Obviously, I decided I liked China and I started learning Chinese. And as I'm sure many of your listeners know, you sort of start out in the language, and then there's a period of time when you're trying to decide what to do with it. And I actually remember as a kind of snotty junior Thanksgiving, or maybe I was a senior at that point, being at some relative's house in upstate New York. And it was one of these scenes where the mothers were in the kitchen baking pies and the fathers were all in the living room sitting in bar loungers with cans of beer. And Jim was wandering around ostentatiously with a copy of Ba Jin's Jia under his arm, sort of trying to read it in all the various rooms. And Uncle Larry looked at me and saw this and said, "Ha, Chinese studies, what are you going to do with that?" So I'm glad, that I find something to do with it. But so that trend got me into China, and eventually I found my way to history. But on the way, there was sort of a legacy of the classics that I studied. And after I graduated from college, I was at Harvard, and I had a job with the Let's Go travel guidebook.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And they sent me, possibly because of my classical background, or my background in classics, they sent me to Greece for the summer, which was, you couldn't ask for a better job than that. I got to travel around the island. I had to produce a lot of copy, but it was great fun. And Turkey as well. And so I left the northeast of the U.S. and I went to Asia, where I was going to be spending the next year doing Chinese in Taiwan, via Greece and Turkey. And I had a great time in Turkey. And so, thinking in this kind of crazy blue sky way that I think young people can do, I was thinking, how can I link up this new interest in Turkey that I've just developed with my chosen métier as a China scholar? And I thought, Xinjiang. And so that's sort of why that planted the seed of looking at far western China. At that point, I wasn't thinking so much about Central Asia outside of China, but I was interested in Xinjiang, started reading about it in some of the travel literature, and so on and so forth. And it was interesting because at that point, there hadn't been a lot of recent work on the area at all. There was the odd news account. There was some concern about possible separatism and uprising and so on. So always this kind of ticking story in the news. But not a lot of recent scholarship, in part because people couldn't go there. And so I read a lot of things from the 30s and 40s, travel accounts and some of Owen Lattimore's early work. And it was interesting because Xinjiang had been much more part of China studies in that early, even pre-war generation, than it was in the 1970s, early 1980s yet. For the China historians in your audience, they will be familiar with Paul Cohen's book, Discovering History in China, and the move to sort of have a China-centered history of China. And that was the period of time and the historiography and the scholarship that I came up in the field in, and we were kind of turning to China and not looking at China as reacting to the West, moving away from impact response, less stress on diplomatic history of China, which of course had played such a big role in the Fairbank era approach to China. And so within that context, I wanted to work on Xinjiang, and nobody was. And I, at points in graduate school, thought, maybe I should do, peasant rebellions or something like that, because that seemed to be more where the field was. So I was kind of, shooting in the dark. And I did have some people. I was at Stanford for my PhD, Albert Dean was there in Asian languages, but he had great interests in nomads and in Central Eurasia as part of his work on early medieval China. So he could sort of help me a little bit, but it was kind of a strange and a little bit scary thing to be working on. I stuck with it. I'm very glad that I did, and ended up, writing a couple of books about Xinjiang, my dissertation about Qing Xinjiang, and then I did a survey history of the region. And in the meanwhile, for my teaching, as part of my stable repertoire of courses, I added in a survey on a survey on Central Eurasian or Central Asian history. Again, there were some intentional and some accidental reasons for that. The accidental reasons included the fact that I ended up working at Georgetown, where we had China historians and state historians who were teaching those standard surveys already. And I came in after a couple of years teaching at University of Arizona as under a line known as intersocietal history. And I sort of had to sell myself as someone who did the study of the interstices, the study of contacts between cultures and civilizations, of borderlands and frontiers. And that wasn't a hard case to make, given that I'd been working on Xinjiang and Mongolia and so on. But then I kind of had to live up to that that name of my line as intersocietal history. And there are there's a strong interest with Georgetown in world history or in intersocietal history. Some of the courses that I taught the master's students was sort of a world history survey. Obviously, at the graduate level, you can't survey in any level of detail, but we tried to look at issues of interactions over the long durée. And I also taught world history at a basic level. Right. So those perspectives were there, and I was absorbing them from some of my colleagues and from the teaching duties that I had. And I was able to work them into the design of my course on Central Eurasia, or on Eurasian history. And by Central Eurasia, I include everything really from the Caucasus all the way out to Manchuria. Sometimes it's a cultural definition, sometimes it's a geographical definition, sometimes it's ecological, with a focus on the steppes. It sort of varies with the time period and so on. But I have a very broad approach. And in developing that course then, it was very natural to not simply talk about nomad empires, or not simply talk about China's relations with the Xiongnu or the Turks or the Mongols and so on, but to broaden it to look at what the role, again, over the very long durée, what has been the role of Central Eurasia and Central Eurasian peoples on the broader canvas of world history. And that's the general approach that I've worked on.
Now, the book that we're talking about today is a general history of the Silk Road. On the one hand, it can be for general readers, but also one can imagine teaching with this, or using this to learn a lot about a region that we don't specialize in, even for academics. So the book is also a part of the Oxford A Very Short Introduction series for listeners or readers who might be familiar with other examples of work in that series. Now, you just talked about a survey that you put together in Central Eurasian history at Georgetown. Was that ultimately the impetus for putting together this book? Or if not, can you talk about how you came to work on a project like this and how this particular book in this particular series actually came about and how that relates to the work that you're doing in terms of your teaching and your research?
Sure. I wouldn't say the course was an impetus for the book exactly. It certainly provided the underpinnings, and I've drawn on the course and some of the material I have in lectures and perspectives and so on in the book. But this is a book on the idea of the Silk Road. It's not an attempt to do a survey of Central Eurasian history in general. There are some other new good ones on the market for that. But various things. I mean, I've been obviously working on Xinjiang all this time, working on Central Eurasian history more generally. The concept of Silk Road comes up. There are lots of books and museum exhibitions and even an NHK documentary using the Silk Road. And in many ways, it's still. And I had learned over time when trying to explain what is Central Eurasia. What am I interested in? What I work on? Sometimes, for the Uncle Larrys of the world, needed to explain it in terms that I could get across more readily. And generally, people have heard of the Silk Road. So sometimes I would just say, as a shorthand, say, "Oh, well, I'm a historian of the Silk Road, or I work in the Silk Road, or something like that." And then people sort of more or less know what that is. More than that, though, and this is perhaps, I'm admitting kind of the meretricious side of this project, but Silk Road is kind of a marketing concept in a way. It's, an attractive idea. It plays on all the exotic aspects of the region that bring people into it. And so not long after I first became familiar with this Oxford series, these very short introductions. And I think like many people, the first time I saw that, I stood there at the little bookshelf, wherever it was, and started pulling them off, saying, "Oh, wow, quantum physics. Oh, gee, Foucault. Boy, I really should bone up on these subjects." And you end up walking out with three or four of them, usually. They're sort of like candy that way. And so the penny dropped, and I thought, aha. And I looked up, and I saw they didn't have a Silk Road one. Of course, at this point, they had China history or Chinese history and the various other things that I might be able to approach. But they didn't have the Silk Road, and so I pitched it to them. And so initially, that was it. It was like, aha, this is a chance to do a short book. It might sell some copies. I'd be able to write in this somewhat more popular mode that I'm enjoying writing in after having written the Survey of Xinjiang History, Eurasian Crossroads. And then the more I looked at the series, and I realized that actually there's a, other than just being attractive little paperbacks that are reasonably priced, they are really trying to do something which I think is quite important, and that is they're not an encyclopedia article, right? They're not a longer version of the Wikipedia page on a given subject. What they're trying to do more than simply provide an introduction is to bring readers into some of the debates, into the conversation within the field in an interesting way, but without overwhelming them, of course, with specialized material right off the bat. And so that then got me thinking, okay, well, rather than just to go through and tell the same old stories and anecdotes about the Silk Road that every other book on the subject has done, maybe I can think about the subject a little more broadly, maybe a little bit different, in a different fashion, maybe in perhaps a somewhat controversial fashion, and then have still more fun in writing this short book.
So what to you, before we get into the structure of the book and the contents of the book, because you've just mentioned it, this is probably a good time to ask you about this. You've mentioned that you wanted to get into some of the more controversial aspects of Silk Road history. So for you, what were some of the most the more controversial aspects of Silk Road history that you brought to your work in the book?
Mm-hmm. I think mainly controversy may be making slightly too strong a case about it, but there's some differences in the field or differences in people's ideas over the definitions, both geographical and chronological, and also about really what the Silk Road was. And we have an image when we mention it, which generally involves camels and caravans. It involves marketplaces filled with luxury goods, with spices, obviously silk, things like this, flowing across the continent. But our image also, I think if people interrogate their image a little bit, think about it, it also is quite focused on China and on Rome. We tend to think about things moving from China to Rome or the other way as what makes the Silk Road important. And in various ways, each of those concepts are if not entirely wrong, then they misplace the emphasis, at least the emphasis I see it on, what is important about the Silk Road. So the Silk Road really is a modern term. It was invented in the late 19th century by a German geographer, von Richthofen. No. Is it? Sorry, you read the book more recently than me. It's not von Richthofen, is it?
You mentioned von Richthofen in the book. It was used as a title by a different guy, but I think Hermann was the guy who used the title.
And then there's Snoopy's Red Baron, who was the nephew of von Richthofen. Right. So invented then by von Richthofen as a term for trade of Chinese silk, in roughly the first century of the Common Era. And from then sort of expanded, and we got this idea of Chinese silk moving for centuries and centuries across this sort of great highway across Asia. And in fact, the opening of Central Asia and Chinese contacts to Central Asia, and from there to India and Iran, and to a very slight degree to sort of the Mediterranean basin and Rome and so on. That happened for a couple of centuries there at the beginning, but by the 6th or 7th century, there was really very little Chinese silk at all, certainly in form made up as textiles, flowing that far, in part because the technology had escaped from China and other people were making it, particularly in Persia, in part because there were our idea of this sort of vast market for, you know, Chinese products, which is colored by the contemporary, you know, what's going on in the contemporary world. We're all buying all these Chinese products. That never really existed for Chinese silk. Silk was never a commodity that was traded in huge volumes. It was a luxury good, which, you know, went to the very, very affluent in small amounts at all. So that's sort of part of, you know, the misnomer. And as I say in the book, you know, neither silk nor a road, you know, discuss. So that was one thing I wanted to try to correct. Another aspect that I was hoping to bring out, or a question that I wanted to address, is a belief, a statement we see very commonly in the scholarly literature, particularly in sort of textbook type literature, that the Silk Road ended, you know, died, or became moribund in the 16th century, and this end, this death of the Silk Road, has been linked to the rise of direct maritime communications between Western Europe and Asia. And that's a very compelling argument, particularly for, you know, world historians, because it links up all sorts of things. It connects old world trade and sort of, you know, the story of how the old world ticked along with what's going to be the story of modernity and the opening of maritime communications, ultimately the new world, and so on and so forth. And so, as I say, it's a very compelling argument that once ships were plying the waters between Europe and Southeast Asia and China, then, you know, that diverted trade in Chinese luxuries and killed the Silk Road. You know, it makes a certain amount of sense. The problem is it's wrong. And it's wrong for various reasons. One reason it's wrong is simply we can demonstrate empirically that although there were some down times, you know, even quite long for periods of decades or centuries and so on, by the 18th century and 19th century, particularly after the Qing Dynasty conquered Xinjiang and reopened trade routes there and so on, trade with Central Asia, trade with Russia, and trade in items that look very much like the traditional Silk Road, horses for textiles. I mean, you can't get more typical of Silk Road trade than that, right? Sima Qian talks about this, and this was how Han relations with Xiongnu involved these kind of trading, and the Tang with the Turks and so on. So you can't get much more Silk Road-y than horses for textiles. And there's huge amounts of horses for textiles trade with Kazakhs, with Mongols, with Tibetans, and Chinese silk, Chinese rhubarb, tea, were moving from central and southern China all the way out to the steppes, ultimately to, you know, Russia even, and so on. So, you know, if that's not Silk Road trade, I don't know what would be. And that, unlike earlier epochs, that we actually have really good documentation for in the Qing archives. I mean, you can get actual quantitative data and precise quantitative data on silk exchange for Kazakh horses and other livestock. So, and anyway, there's that. And a scholar named Scott Levy has also done work looking at trade from North India through Central Asia with Russia and the role of played by Samarkand and Bukhara and their merchants as entrepôts and intermediaries in trade between Mughals and Central Asia and Russia. And he shows a very similar sort of story. There were tremendous amounts of trade, traditional style, overland, you know, caravan trade, exchange of horses for textiles and so on, going on in modern times. So that's, you know, just an empirical problem with the idea that the Silk Road died once maritime trade with Europe opened up. But really, it's a conceptual issue more than simply an empirical one, because this idea that overland trade routes would be in competition with the European Asian trade routes, again, is based on a notion of what the Silk Road was. It's not accurate. It's based on an idea that it was, what was important about it was that it was large volumes, something more similar to modern kind of commodity trade, the kind of things that could be diverted and therefore would make a difference, rather than sporadic, fairly small volume trade in luxuries and so on. And also, there's one other shibboleth, I guess you could call it, about the Silk Road, and that's this focus on long-distance trade between the Far East and the Far West. The horizontal, the east-west side of it. Mm-hmm. Rather than looking at local, regional, relatively shorter distance, but still not, still covering a lot of ground, trade between civilizational centers, that is, the big population centers, urban agrarian civilization, and the nomads of the steppe, be they in Mongolia or further west. And in fact, if you really want to find large volumes of exchange historically, you're not going to find it on the backs of camels led by individual merchants operating as private entrepreneurs, but rather you're going to find it in state-sponsored exchanges, so interstate exchanges, in particular China. I've mentioned just a moment ago the trade in textiles, or in later days in tea or livestock from nomads, right? And this was, for the most part, carried out under state auspices as part of Chinese policies for dealing with nomad groups. It was very much a strategic kind of trade. It was important strategically, much more than it was important economically. And again, as anyone who's done some Chinese history knows, these kinds of exchanges were often carried out by Chinese states at a loss, but in order to achieve strategic goals rather than to make money off of them. So the other aspect of this then is what is sometimes called north-south or trans-ecological trade between urban agrarian societies, China, but also India, Iran, and peoples of the steppe. And when you realize that the Silk Road is much more about that, and that those exchanges were both larger and arguably historically more significant than the relative trickle of goods that got all the way from one end of Eurasia to the other, from that point of view, then you quickly realize that it doesn't matter if Dutch or Portuguese or later even British vessels are making it all the way from the northwestern peninsula of Europe to China, that they're not going to interrupt the regional exchanges between nomad groups and Chinese or other urban agrarian societies.
Great, thank you. You actually have mentioned a lot of, have touched on a lot of the really interesting things that come up in the various chapters of the book that I was going to, and I'll ask you about different aspects of in the time we have. So thank you. So let's talk about the structure of the book. The book is organized into 6 chapters that each take a different thematic approach to narrating the history of the Silk Road, however problematic that, Silk Road here is in scare quotes. So if I had my scare quote castanets, I'd be...
Right, no, you're allowed to. I use the term, in fact, I have, gone back and forth. Do you capitalize Silk Road or, and so on and so forth. I'm trying to make money off of this concept, so I allow people to use the term.
Okay. I usually keep my little castanets around, sonically punctuated.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I highly recommend it for talks. But so the 6 chapters collectively, and I'll just read them out very briefly, especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to take a look at the book: Environment and Empires, Eras of Silk Road Florescence, the Biological Silk Road, the Technological Silk Road, the Arts on the Silk Road, and a kind of concluding chapter that pushes us forward that's called Whither the Silk Road. Now, collectively, these chapters raise really important issues that are relevant not just to Silk Road history, but that also speak to conceptual issues, issues of craft and of narrative in world history and really history writing more generally. It's kind of taken together a snapshot introduction to some of the major conceptual approaches to world history writing. And so I think there's a lot in the book that's obviously specifically germane to Silk Road history, but there's a lot to take out of this for readers who are just interested in world history more generally. So as we move into the body of the book, can you talk a little bit about that structure and those decisions? Why Why did you come up with these particular themes for these chapters, and were there any major transformations in how you thought about the structure of the book from the time you started working on it until the time that it was published?
Yeah, I think when I first thought that I would do a Silk Road book, again, there's a chronological approach that one can do, I think. Other books that have been written have focused more on China have more or less sort of gone through the material, so starting in the Han, moving through to the Tang, generally kind of ending before the Mongol period for some reason or another. But there's an emphasis on China's expansion into Central Asia, an emphasis on Buddhism, therefore the important context with India, and of course the great heroes, the traveler Zhang Qian, Han Wudi's military exploits, Shenzong, the Buddhist traveler, and so on and so forth. So, I think probably the first impulse is just to kind of go through that material again and tell those stories. And I wanted to do something a little different, and while not decentering China entirely, I wanted to, or decentering is not the right word, but I wanted to put, in this discussion of the Silk Road, I wanted to put China in this broader Eurasian context. And so to do that, more or less following the trajectory of Chinese history was not going to allow me to do that. And then as I thought about it thematically and started developing my arguments that I wanted to make about the Silk Road that I was just talking about, I realized that what the Silk Road really is, or the way I'm using the term, is as kind of a shorthand for the history of exchanges across Eurasia over a long period of time. I've just argued that one can continue it into modern times. One also can begin well before the first century. One can begin with really the first humans coming out of Africa and populating the Eurasian continent, and exchanges of early agriculture, of domesticated plants, animals, and so on and so forth. So that's how I wanted to use it, as a shorthand, kind of as an iconic term for the very long-term process of exchange, not just of goods, but of ideas and also biological material across and throughout Eurasia. And a analogy that came to me in the process was that of the Columbian Exchange, which, of course, was very traumatic and, in historical terms, very sudden. The advent of Western Europeans on the North American continent, with all of the biological effects and other sorts of things from that. And that happened in a relative blink of an eye with very traumatic impacts. But I think a similar kind of long-term exchange took place across Eurasia, not a sudden flow, but rather an ongoing trickle. But nonetheless, the overall effects of this were analogous to that of the Columbian Exchange. So that became kind of the model that I wanted to look at. And so once I thought about it in those terms, then the structure of the book broke down to introducing the general ideas. And then I had to throw in a chapter which is kind of a nutshell political history of, that's chapter two, Eras of Silk Road Florescence, of Central Eurasia. And the major nomad empires and some aspects of their relations with China and other sedentary agrarian powers. And I wanted to do that simply so that I could refer to these groups without having to always be explaining along the way. Because one thing you learn very quickly doing Central Eurasian history is that it's no comment on the readership, but this is not something that we get any kind of exposure to in the normal course of an education, right? We learn very little, maybe about the Mongols, but we tend, learn very little about these groups. So I had to kind of throw that in there. I hope people can get past, or don't bog down in chapter two, which, I am kind of lecturing a little bit and giving a lot of information in that. And then the main body of the book is really a series of examples of exchanges biological, technological, and artistic before I come to the end and, you know, wax philosophical on what I think the Silk Road means.
Now, one of the things that's very striking about the style of the book, in particular the narrative style, is the way you're relating the here and now of you as a writer and of your reader to the history of the Silk Road, sort of the present to the past. The prose is actually really funny at times, it's very vivacious, and it's always making connections between the past and the present. Now, this is true not just for the sort of readability, the style of the book, but it's also true in terms of how you're approaching some aspects of Silk Road history. So as we move into the first chapters, and, you know, we may not get to all the chapters today, mm-hmm. let's at least try to get to some of them.
Okay.
One of the things that happens in the first two chapters, the first one in particular, but this also comes up later in the book, is that you're able to relate Silk Road history in general to some more contemporary world historical themes. And so you're playing here with ideas of globalization and in its analogy to what's happening in Silk Road history. You mention the term cosmopolitanism a couple of times mm-hmm. in the first couple of chapters. So would you talk a little bit about that? Because that's another aspect of doing world histories and doing the history of this kind of region or set of regions or historical entity that can be... it's something that I think all of us who are working on world historical kinds of themes have to negotiate for ourselves, right? To what extent do we use concepts that are coming from contemporary geopolitical conversations to describe what's happening in the past? And I think you do it very effectively here, but you're very, it seems like you're very conscious of using that kind of language in here. So I would love if you could talk a little
bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, part of the reason for the contemporary references, I think, is simply I was trying to have fun with it as I went, and you know, to bounce back and forth and try to make some of this stuff as relevant as I can. But you're absolutely right. I am. I just spent 5 minutes trying to explain my notion of the Silk Road, but I could have simply used the word globalization and probably would have gotten people close to what I meant, you know, much more quickly. Yes, I'm very much treating the Silk Road as, I guess, proto-globalization would be a little bit slightly better term. I think I use both in the book. With one caveat, in that what we think about globalization today, you know, we think about it as something relatively new, and it's closely associated with high volumes of exchange of trade around the world, and also with very high speed interactions, both the way we personally move around and also obviously the way we communicate. Now, in ancient and medieval and even early modern times, not so much stuff was moving and it wasn't moving so fast. And this is obvious. So quantitatively, when I'm talking about the Silk Road, you know, quantitatively, it's not comparable to modern exchanges. But I think qualitatively, it is. And so that's why that's very much, as you say, the model of how I'm thinking about it.
Another thing that comes up early in the book that's really interesting, and this is something that also I think for those of us who spend any time teaching Central Eurasian history or teaching world history, this tends to be a feature of many approaches to Silk Road history, is in some sort of invocation of the importance of the environment, the climate, the geography, in influencing what's happening in Silk Road history, but also more generally in influencing human society and politics. So how conscious were you in putting this together how much did you want to emphasize that, and how much did you include that as a kind of matter of course, because this is something that, you know, we do see in a lot of Silk Road history. So how important is it for you to foreground that, or can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, in Central Eurasian history in general, the way I teach it, and I think the way a lot of people do, is almost to, I begin almost anthropologically looking at pastoral nomadism. You know, what is it as a way of life? Why is it adopted? How is it connected to agriculture? Why it's different from hunter-gathering? Why it's not particularly primitive, but it's rather a technology in and of itself of using livestock to get energy out of the land, out of grasslands when people can't eat grass, and so on and so forth. One thing that emerges very, very clearly from that kind of approach, and this isn't original with me, in a sense, Owen Lattimore, when talking about the steppe zone and China and the marginal zone between, the marginal Great Wall zone between China and Mongolia, he was very cognizant of this too, is that the ecological differences between the deserts and steppes of Central Eurasia and agrarian lands sets up an economic dynamic that in many ways shapes the political and military relationship between agrarian powers and steppe powers. And it also sets up a certain sociological and political dynamic among steppe peoples themselves. Very briefly put, the organization of the nomadic tribes of Central Eurasia tends to be segmentary, and it tends to oscillate between periods of fragmentation and relatively few but very remarkable and important periods of unification and confederation when the great nomad empires come together. The Turkic Khaganate, or obviously the Mongols. When they did come together like that and were able to concentrate military power, there were very few sedentary societies that could withstand them. So that dynamic comes out of, is closely related to, ecological factors. And also, so the ecological / economic aspects of pastoral nomadism as an economy and as a life way. And there's an interesting kind of danger here because, historians caution against geographical determinism. And in fact, if you read, for example, what Gibbon said about nomadic peoples, or even what some of the Roman writers and the ancient Greek writers said about them, they saw them nomads living very much in a state of nature, as very much creatures of nature, somehow often less human, and responding to these natural signals and behaving the way they did because they're more like beasts than humans. Ironically enough, with this focus on ecology, with interests in environmental history and trying to look for environmental factors behind human society and how humans interact and so on, there's kind of a danger that we take the old lady of geographical determinism and dress her up again in new garb as environmental history, right? So one has to be sort of aware of that. Nonetheless, it's a very, very striking kind of relation that one sees. And as I mentioned before, in part, it's the ecological differences between these parts of Eurasia that sets up the exchanges that are how I talked about you talk about the Silk Road. There's one other factor related to this that I could have mentioned a moment ago. The reason I spend some time talking about nomadic peoples at the beginning of the book is that it's not simply that they were there in the lands in between or the lands over which the Silk Road traveled, but in fact they were very, very active agents in determining what sorts of things got exchanged and how they got exchanged. And this happened in a variety of ways. The most basic level I was mentioning, textiles for livestock exchanges. Obviously, they needed that kind of trade. But even the luxuries and foodstuffs, but artworks, other sorts of things like that, is very often the consumption choices of nomadic elites, particularly at times of great empires, when they had power, when they could bring people from vast distances, to their courts, be it in northern Mongolia or the northern part of Xinjiang or wherever, they were actually determining what kinds of things were exchanged. There were also important nomadic states, in particular the Kushan state in the 1st and 2nd century AD, located in what is now Afghanistan, or Bactria as it was known then, in northern India, who played a very important role in mediating the dissemination of Buddhism. As patrons of Buddhism and supporters of Buddhism, as conveners of a great religious conclave for Buddhism, they played an active role in assuring that Buddhism spread out of North India and helping it get into Central Asia and to China, and also shaping some of the ways in which, you know, what schools, what sutras were important, and so on. It went through the Kushan area. So, again, there's a neglected historical role for nomadic peoples, which is why I really wanted to make sure that I got those that history into this book.
Thank you. Now, there's also a chapter that I'm not going to ask you to talk too much about, because you've already sort of talked a little bit about it, but I just will mention it just to flag it for listeners. This is the chapter 2, or the second chapter, rather, which looks at, it's a kind of capsule political history of the Silk Road region, and it looks in particular at the importance of centralized states and confederations in shaping the political history on the Eurasian steppe. So I'll just kind of mark that. It's a really interesting part of the book. What I want to do is move, though, briefly from environment and geography to kind of a related set of issues, and this comes up in the third chapter of the book, The Biological Silk Road. Now, you say in this chapter, and it's really interesting here for this reason, that biological exchanges, and you talk about several kinds of them, you use examples of grape wine, of horses, you talk about DNA as a way to map human migrations. These biological exchanges, you say, provide a map, a kind of a map to the multi-directional networks that were the Silk Road. And so this is a way of not just giving a snapshot of, from another perspective of Silk Road history, but actually creating a kind of historical map. So this, I would love to hear you talk a little bit about that, but specifically what I wanted to ask you about is something you talk about in this section called the Full Monty. Mm-hmm. So you talk in this section of the book about another kind of, think of a biological network that maps Silk Road interactions, and this was a network of dumplings, including the kind of Swabian or Swabian meat ravioli, the little god cheaters you talk about on 63, and to which the book is actually dedicated. So can you talk a little bit about the importance of dumplings for you, and how did this become the dedication of the book?
Anybody who's eaten dumplings, I think, will understand why one probably should. Exactly. Eventually, so. Well, I think there's a lot that goes into a dumpling. And one thing is, one kind of little problem that I had, or issue that came up in writing, in dividing the book up the way it did, and having a section on the biological Silk Road, and distinguishing that particularly from sort of technologies, is that, well, you know, what is, let me just sort of start with silk. What is silk? Is silk a technology, or is it a biology, right? Reading of silk. And when you look at the making of a particular kind of dumpling, well, that, I guess, you might not usually call it technology, but, you know, cooking methods and skills, it's more in the sort of area of, art and science and ideas, rather than in, you know, pure biological exchange, for example, of pathogens, right? Which world historians might talk about that way. There's a certain blurring here. But, you know, if we think about what a dumpling is, and here I'm talking mainly about gyoza or gyoza kind of dumpling, Peking ravioli, right? With a thin skin around a meat or vegetable filling. Well, generally that outer skin is made of wheat, and this is hard wheat, which itself was exchanged very early on from the Fertile Crescent to China and the Far East, and had quite important effects in China in that it allowed for, you know, a third winter crop in North China of grains to be grown. It complemented the millet and barley, which were probably indigenously domesticated in China, but added this other important foodstuff there. And then there are various reasons to suspect that the dumpling itself, that is the Jiaozi kind of dumpling, or known in Turkic languages and Korean and many other languages as, you know, mante, mandu, there's a whole bunch of these sort of related words. There's reason to believe that, if not a steppe invention itself, it was closely related to the steppes or to Central Eurasia. I sort of asked around and asked some linguists and this and that, and there's, of course, this interesting similarity between the word mantou, you know, for steamed bread in Chinese, and manta. And if you look at the characters for mantou, well, there's nothing really in them to suggest that there is the sort of grain or the food radical on the side, but there's nothing really to suggest that this is an ancient Chinese term, as opposed to possibly a transliteration of a word from another language, right? But it's probably very difficult to get to the absolute bottom of this one way or another and say whether, you know, manto, which in ancient times, such as Song times, manto actually had filling, so they were more similar to jiaozi than manto are today. In any case, there's this association of the word all across Eurasia, this emergence of this word. And then also, our earliest example of a mantis or of a jiaozi is actually one that's fossilized, was found in a gravesite near Turfan, dating back, I think, to the 6th century or something. You can see it in the Turfan Museum today, a ossified or fossilized dumpling. And then some indications from how the analog to this foodstuff in Russia, the pelmeni, the folklore about it is that Russian hunters learned about this from some Siberian tribesmen, and that it was used when out on hunts. You know, they sort of make these and have them frozen, and you just simply could boil them up for a quick meal. In any case, there's sort of a raft of intriguing connections to the steppe with this. And plus, of course, the basic fact that, you know, wheat itself was exchanged across Eurasia to get to the Far East. So anyway, to me, it seemed to be a nice symbol of these very early kinds of connections and the way in which the societies of Eurasia are linked. Now, I'm cheating a little bit with the reference to this Swabian or, you know, German dumpling. German is not one of my languages, so I'm probably butchering the pronunciation. But it means little god cheaters. And I just like the idea of that. And so I dedicated the book to them and all their cousins. They're called god cheaters because during Lent, the argument goes, you're not supposed to eat meat, but, you know, if you tuck the meat inside a dumpling, then God couldn't see what you were eating. I just like the cheekiness of that idea.
Well, so as we come to the last 10 minutes or so of our time, I'm not going to ask you to talk too much about chapter 4 or too much about the other chapters, but I'll just again signal for listeners that chapter 4 is there. It's called The Technological Silk Road, and among the different technologies that you're looking at here are chairs, silk, textile for horse trade that you've mentioned earlier, paper, medical technologies such as attention to humors, variolation for smallpox, and various kinds of military technology. So historians of technology or people interested in that part of world history might pay particular attention to that part of the book. Now, what I want to ask you about before we move to our conclusion, actually, is something that comes up in chapter 5, and this is the arts of the Silk Road. It's a chapter that starts with you're mentioning a children's TV program in Taiwan in the early 1980s that invokes a kind of theme that you see unity coming from the putting a bunch of sticks together and not being able to snap them instead of, you know, just being able to snap one stick. This is a theme that comes up in a lot of different kinds of stories that you, I think, show us really nicely at the beginning of that chapter. And it's precisely this attention to the kind of exchange and circulation and movement of stories and of themes and motifs more generally that's so wonderful in this chapter. So the chapter looks at of the kind of movement along the Silk Road of stories, the Jakarta, the Panchatantra. It looks at the movement of visual motifs, such as the three hairs, the halo. It talks about Persian miniatures and blue and white ware. But for me, as a banjo player, of course, the things that...
You're a banjo player.
Yeah, I'm a very bad banjo player. And of course, the section of this chapter that I just loved, and my little note in the margin was, yay for lutes, was a section on lutes. And lutes as a kind of technology or an art that you can see moving throughout this history. So would you talk a little bit about that? Is there, this was a particularly vibrant part of the book. It was really fascinating. And I think not just as somebody who's, you know, interested in this as an instrument, but it seems like you were also really particularly interested in this part of the chapter. So can you talk a little bit about lutes here and what brought you to that as one of the examples?
Sure, very happy to. But let me simply say, I'm a mandolin player and guitar player myself. So
great.
We can talk some other time about pick some tunes together. But your banjo, by the way, has a genetic relationship to the Chinese arhu, somewhat similar to that between various types of dumplings. I don't want to go too much into some banjo morphology, but a lot of banjos, at least, have the neck goes all the way through, right, underneath, inside the drum, comes out the other side, as in a spiked fiddle. Are an arhu. In any case, those kinds of connections and one can see in a lot of lutes. And actually, let me start talking about this with a broader issue that a lot of the connections and exchanges I talk about bring up. One thing I had to think about, and that is the problem of dissemination and direct connection versus independent invention. Right, so convergence, as it's sometimes called, versus diffusion. And this, of course, these have been issues that have troubled archaeologists in particular, and ancient historians for some time. And it's an issue you have to sort of deal with, because some of these things, humans all over the world are very inventive and can certainly come up with some of these ideas themselves in different places. And you can't always be sure, particularly when looking at very old things, whether you're looking at a case of independent invention in different places or of evidence of contacts and of exchange. And the way that I came to dealing with this, and it's, I'm not doing it at a technical level like a archaeologist would have to do, and trying to see if two potsherds or the technology of weaving or something is related two sites, but I'm just kind of looking at it as a rough and ready methodology. If the particular item or idea that you're talking about has unique enough features, things that really sort of stand out, or if the two things that you're comparing and looking for connection between, if there is enough of those particular features similar to them. So for example, a lump of dough with meat in it, in and of itself, if you have, two lumps of dough with meat in it and different ends of the continent, that might not be enough to say that they're close related. But if they're crimped in that triangular way, like a jiaozi in both places, well, then you're closer to it. Okay, so lutes are very good area in which to look at those kinds of things, because we have both some historical evidence and art historical evidence of where these certain types of lutes began, and that's again in North India, Afghanistan. We have our earliest sculptural representations of lutes with multiple strings. There's earlier what's known as long neck lutes with just a couple of strings, which you find earlier in the Fertile Crescent. And then you see, the pipa, and you see various Indian instruments, and you see what's known as the barbat in Persia, and of course the oud in Islamic lands, Arabian lands, which becomes the lute in Europe. And so you can trace this to a certain extent historically, but again, also just looking at the instruments themselves, there are certain features of them, aspects of their construction, sometimes vestigial aspects of them, which play no particular function in modern instruments or in more recent instruments, but which harken back to a day when, for example, this instrument would have been bowed as opposed to flat or something like that. And so these instruments themselves, treated simply as objects, irregardless of the music that's played on them, carry this kind of DNA in them, right? They carry in their morphology, in their construction, the evidence of where they've come from, that you, things you can sort of trace them back to. So in that sense, they're really nice examples of Silk Road exchange. But of course, they're also more than that. They are vehicles for presenting music and playing music. Music is a meaning-laden medium, and also one that's actually closely related to mathematics, to science of acoustics, and so on and so forth. So there's a welter of associations in a musical instrument and in the music that they're played that when we look about it in different places, it's very rich territory for both comparison and also looking for these kinds of connections. And in fact, I'm working currently and have been even sort of before I did this Silk Road book, I started on a project on what I'm calling quarterphone culture, string instrument culture across Eurasia. And as it's come out now, my next book will probably be on Lutes on the Silk Road. Expanding sort of on that little seed that's in here, but also looking at the semiotics of instruments even in modern times, the sitar as a national instrument, for example, the meanings of the pipa, why it was associated in early and medieval Chinese times with barbarians, why the qin is the scholar's instrument, while the pipa is something more popular, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of these kinds of things. So that's my next project, and ultimately the one after that will probably be the globalization of the guitar. But that's still some time in the future.
Well, great. Well, that's actually usually the last question that I ask, but I'll
start. From your sails.
No, not at all. You've put more wind in my sails because I'm now particularly excited to read those books as well. So now, Jim, we've come to the end of our time, and there's of course a ton of stuff about the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, including but not limited to the last chapter where you talk about you really take apart and take on this myth that the Silk Road died and showed that's not really the case, and you also talk about some modern echoes of Silk Road language and of invocations of the Silk Road today or in the very recent past. Is there anything in particular about the book that we didn't have time to talk about but that you'd like to mention, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'd say that if there is an overall it's a theme or thesis in the book. And I wasn't too heavy in laying that on. But I think it would be, and this was something I discovered from the process of writing it, it would be about the nature of exchanges. And I just mentioned a few moments ago, we talk about diffusion and convergence, whether something spread from point A to point B or whether it was independently invented in point A and point B, but in fact that there are hybrids and sort of intermediary versions of this. It's neither one nor the other very often. And maybe the germ of an idea traveled, but then was realized in a different place. Maybe then that new version of this, of the thing, the technology, the idea, moved back the other way and had more inspiration back there, and so on and so forth. And so, whether you're talking about technology or art or religious ideas or music or any of these sorts of things, it's not by any the process of exchange over time, over space, and the long durée is not simple. It's very complicated, and it also involves transculturation processes where, you know, ideas move along with things and sometimes get seated in a new environment. Sometimes that new thing takes on different sets of meanings. And so as I'm looking forward to this Lutz project and so on, I'm thinking very much about the nature of exchange and the complexity of exchanges and interactions in world history, and perhaps developing a somewhat more sophisticated or more complex vocabulary for talking about that than we currently have. So that would be one thing. All right, and then just you mentioned the modern contemporary echoes. And this is something that astounded me, because, of course, when you're working on something like this, you look out for references in the news. Maybe you have a Google alert or something like that. And it's fascinating how frequently the Silk Road is evoked, not just in popular culture or as a marketing tool for restaurants and tourist companies and things, but by politicians and the practitioners of international relations. China does it. Iran does it. The United States recently has rolled out a Silk Road program to try to structure relations between South and Central Asia in a way that we'd like. And so it's very much a current notion. It's a notion to conjure with. The historical resonances of this term remain very important today, which is why I think politicians and nations are reaching for it as a way to define or redefine the relations between states in Central Eurasia.
Well, thank you, Jim, so much for taking the time. The current book is great, and I'm really excited to see the next projects as well. So best of luck with your research on cordiform culture, and it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carla. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.